He has been framed, threatened, and jailed for 18 months in Thailand for leaking PetroSaudi documents said to be related to the 1MDB scandals. The allegations made against him is also said to be false. But despite all that, Swiss whistleblower Javier Justo said he would risk all his life to expose the 1MDB scandal all over again. The former PetroSaudi international executive claims that his family has suffered immensely over his acts and their lives continue to be affected by his actions. But was his efforts were all noble? Or were they really motivated by cash? Astro Awani invites Javier Justo to the studio as we have a frank, heart-to-heart talk into what were his original motives and whether it was indeed the work of a crusading whistleblower or an act of a desperate man. Thanks very much for joining us in this special Astro Awani Bulletin. Joining me again is Javier Justo, the Swiss whistleblower. Javier, thanks for joining us. This will be your first TV interview. Again, it's such an honour for us to have you. And you've been here in Malaysia a few times now after the government has changed. What are your initial thoughts going into the end of the year?
In a way, I'm very proud of you having a new government, of having a non-corrupted government, on having an incredible prime minister, because part of this, maybe a tiny part of this is due to the fact that I gave sensitive data to a UK journalist or to the Malaysian Edge, the Edge company. So there is a sense of proudness about this.
Okay, let's talk about that, because when I asked on social media, on our platform, what are the questions that they want me to ask you? Mm-hmm. A lot of them are asking this. You say that you gave the data because you want to reveal the truth.
Yes.
But a lot of reports, including that from the Billion Dollar Whale book written by the two Wall Street Journal reporters, said that you were actually blackmailing your employers, PetroSaudi. Is there any truth in the fact that you wanted money out of this sensitive data?
There is a kind of truth. I wanted my money. It's not I wanted money from anybody else. This money that I was claiming, this $2.5 million, that was my money, that money that was owed to me by PetroSaudi. So when you are claiming for your money, you are not doing blackmail. And believe me, if I wanted to do blackmail with this data, I would have asked probably a little bit more than my $2.5 million. And there is some evidences that I gave to the Swiss justice, to the Swiss prosecutor, where it's written, I'm writing to Patrick Mahoney and Tarek Obeid, saying, I'm claiming only my $2.5 million. If I wanted to blackmail you, I would ask probably at least $15 million. Since day one, I've been asking the money that was owed to me by Tarek Obeid and Patrick Mahoney.
So still, meaning that the release of this data is motivated by money and not trying to reveal the truth about the scandal that is happening between 1MDB and PetroSaudi?
That's not correct, but I will explain it in detail. So I wanted to have my money back from PetroSaudi, which I think everybody will have done. Claim what is yours. So I spent like probably 2 years, pretty much like having some contacts with them, and they didn't want to pay me.
Yeah.
So,
in the book, Billion Dollar Whale, it says that you went to the Singapore GP, F1 GP, and you wanted to meet Patrick Mahoney and Tarek Obeid. You didn't meet them, but you did meet people from Tun Dr. Mahathir's team, of which over time they are the ones that provided you the contact for Claire Rucastle Brown. Is that part of the story correct?
The Wall Street Journal book, I'm not here to promote any kind of book. It's a nice book to read. There are a few mistakes in this book. I have a Facebook account. It's an open Facebook account, so everybody can check. I did my comments about the books. There are a few mistakes. For example, the first meeting with Claire Castle Brown, the title of the chapter is No Cash, No Deal.
Yeah.
Those are not my words. I mean, believe me and trust me, I was there. I didn't say that. That wasn't the my words. Regarding the Singaporean Grand Prix, I went there a couple of times. I was invited. I didn't ask for any kind of meeting. I spoke to a lot of people. I was in a VIP area. So I spoke with some Malaysian, and I honestly, that's the truth, I don't remember any names. I didn't say, please call me. This was 2011, and I think 2012. I was contacted by Claire in 2014. So believe me, if I would have tried to find somebody in Malaysia in 2011, 3 years, I don't know, that looks strange. But again, whatever the Wall Street Journal wrote is their responsibility. I did my comments on my Facebook page about this point and other points that are inaccurate. Mm-hmm. This is not the truth.
Okay, but there is some truth in that the book wrote that you wanted your money back. Here you're telling me that you still want
your
money back.
I wanted my money back. That's a fact.
All right, so that means that part of the fact is correct in the book.
That I wanted my money back? Absolutely.
Okay, let's talk about you still wanting to get your money. So after Claire Castle Brown reached out to you in 2014 and you wanted money for the data that you plan to release, mm-hmm. And inside it includes, you know, 2 gigabyte of emails.
90
gigabyte.
227,000 emails.
All right. And Claire Castle Brown wanted that data to prove her story, but she didn't have that kind of cash, yeah. The ones that you want. So you reached, Claire Castle Brown reached out to The Edge.
Yes.
Was it true that The Edge wanted to pay you $2 million for that data?
To be clear, to be honest, and again, so I met Claire. She contacted me. I didn't contact her. She came. We met 2 times, I think, and I said, those are a few examples of the data that are inside the disk. There are 227,000 emails. There is no human being that can check those emails. So I told her there are a lot of information. There are pretty much all the story of the Petro-Saudi 1MDB deal. So what I want you to find somebody that is willing to pay me what is owed by Petro-Saudi. I don't want one penny more. And again, you know the information that are, you know the story. Everything is inside. Do you really think that if I wanted to make money, I would only, if we are talking about me being only a money guy.
Yeah.
Why would I only ask for my money? I could have tried to sell this for 5, 10, 20, maybe 50 millions. We're talking about billions of money diverted, about 1.5 billion that were siphoned through the Petro-Saudi deal or scam, whatever you want to call it.
Okay, of course, that's the intention. And the fact is that you never did get money from Hoketat of The Edge or Claire. Nobody gave you money. How did you feel about that?
I'm going to be very open and very clear and very honest with you. So I met Mr. Tong and Mr. Ketat. Claire was there in Singapore. And we had a very frank discussion. Honestly, they explained me from A to Z the knowledge of this 1MDB commission machine that was ruining your country. So he said, how much you want for that? I said, hey, I'm not like selling a car. I'm looking to recover my money. If you're willing to do so, that's great. So that's what happened. I gave the data. I said, how do you want to be paid? I said, we'll settle that one day. It's in the Claire's book. He even wanted to give me a painting as a collateral. I say, we are gentlemen, so just shake hands and let's do it. Of course, after that, I've been arrested and you know the full story. So that's it. I wasn't paid. I haven't been paid. Mm-hmm. Maybe I will be paid one day. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You have to understand, it's not my priority. I was never a money man. If I were a money man, I should have tried to sell those data for probably 50 millions.
Okay.
Like, I met Ketat. I had a dinner with him last time. He's my friend. So it's not the priority of the moment is not this.
You're watching the special edition of Bulletin Awani. Joining me is Javier Justo, the 1MDB whistleblower, in his first televised interview. And again, Javier, I'd really like to thank you for coming over and the people that brought you here in Malaysia for this particular conference. You're attending the 10th International Conference on Financial Crime, and Mr. V. Maslamani has actually asked you over. What would be the key topics that you will be talking about in the IFCTF conference?
So first, I would like to thank Mr. Mani, the chairman of this International Conference of International Crimes and Financing Terrorism. I feel very proud and very flattered to have been invited as a speaker to this conference. So
yeah, the part of the main purpose of this conference and many conferences like this is understanding the financial crime that is currently happening in Malaysia. But before we touch on the 1MDB investigations, I'd like to talk a little bit about the personal impact on you. You were quoted by the press very recently saying that you would still do it again. And, you know, I think this is in relation to you being jailed in Thailand. My sister wanted me to ask this. How was it like being locked up 1.5 years in a Thai prison?
I have a smile, not because it's a funny experience, because it brings me back some souvenirs. I'm a Swiss citizen, okay? I spent all my life in Geneva. I was a banker, so I was used to a nice level of life. I was living in Thailand. We were building this resort that we had to sell. Until the moment I was jailed, I was living not a dream life, but a very, very good life. So from day one to until the next following day, when I was sent to jail, it's from being in heaven and sent immediately to the lowest level on
earth.
Yes. So what is like living in a Thai prison facility? You sleep, or you try to sleep, with 50 people around you. On the ground, there is no bed. You have to share a kind of toilet, shower, for everybody is using this hall and this basket of water. You are in the cell from 3 in the afternoon until 6 in the morning. You are not allowed to have food from 3 in the afternoon to 6 in the morning. You're just allowed to have a bottle of water. The lights are turned on all night. And if you think that is in studio, there is a lot of light, it's less than in a Thai prison.
How much lights are we talking about here?
The lights, just because there are some cameras to avoid any kind of violence or rape, all the lights are turned on during the night. I haven't seen the night from the 22nd of June, 2015, when I was arrested, until the end of December, 2016. There is no night, and you can't sleep. You have to sleep on the ground. You have 3 blankets. One is to protect you from the dirtiness of the ground. One, you have to like try to make a pillow with it, and the last one, you just to cover yourself.
So then, why do you say that you would do it again, as in whistleblowing 1MDB?
Because, and that may sound ridiculous for a lot of people, I'm very, very proud of what I did. I'm very proud of what I did to survive in prison, to fight. It's a fight. Surviving in prison, it's a fight. And I am very proud of. I was in love with my wife since the moment I met her. She has been so brave. She has been so courageous. She has been a fighter to take me out of jail. So those things are a kind of a discovery of who I am, really, of who my wife is. It's a good lesson. I will do it again. But frankly speaking, I would avoid to go back to prison. But to expose a crime, in a way, it's a noble act. I'm proud of it. I'm proud that my son is only 4 years old now, so he cannot read.
Yeah.
One day we'll know the real story of his father.
This is the second question my sister wanted me to ask you. What do you tell your son of the ordeal, everything that happened to you, or whatever that he can get his hands on, the press materials, or even more than that?
I've started to write a book with my wife. Not about the 1MDB affair, the Petro Saudi affair, the financial crimes. It's not about that. It's about our personal experience, what happened to us, why I did that, what my wife has to do to protect me. I want him to know the truth, the real truth, not some articles, not some books where the truth is sometimes 90% accurate. I want him to know the truth, whether he will like it or not, whether he will think maybe you shouldn't have done that, father, because mom suffered. It will be his decision. I want him, I want my family, I want my friends to know the truth.
So let's talk about the truth right now. The question that one of our Twitter followers, Kananga, wants me to ask you is that the 1MDB Petro-Saudi deal, we know what other people have written about it. Claire has written about it. I've read a book. P. Gunasegaram has written about it. I've read his book. And of course, The Billion Dollar Whale. I've read the book twice. I want to know your thoughts. Was the Petro-Saudi 1MDB deal really a genuine business transaction, but somehow or other it turned sour halfway? Or was it purposefully done to steal money from the Malaysian public?
It was since day one done to steal the money. And so I was a banker, but at the same time, I was my best friend, or one of my very best friends, was Tarek Obeid since the middle of the 90s. He created this Petro-Saudi company, I think in 2005 or 2006. This company had only one good asset. It's the name. It looks like a Saudi government company. But from 2006 until the Malaysian money went through the Petro-Saudi accounts or the whatever deal, it was almost a non-existing company. In Geneva, they were hiring a part-time employee. And I know that because they were located in my offices. In Saudi Arabia, which was supposed to be the center of the business, there was only a guy picking up the phone. And in London, there were three old UK oil men, part-time paid. So there was almost a non-existent company until September 2009, when they did this famous joint venture between the 1MDB company and the Petro-Saudi company.
And but at this point, you came into Petro-Saudi.
So I was already a director of Petro-Saudi since day one. I was just signing some annual reports, some boards of meetings of the boards, but there were no activity.
If you're there since day one, you know what the ongoing says. You were saying, only Patrick Mahoney and Tarek Obeid knows what's going on.
Yes, but let me finish. So I was an employee I wasn't paid. I never got any money from Petro-Saudi from 2005 until I came to London. I left Geneva and I quit it. I sold my company. I resigned as a Petro-Saudi director. I think it was in August 2009, okay? Before the deal was done. I left, I went to Asia. I was in Thailand with my wife when the deal was done. So in February 2010, a few months after the deal was done and they received the money, Tarek Obeid, the one of the two owners of Petro-Saudi, called me a few times to make me come back to London and work officially for Petro-Saudi. At the beginning, I refused. I was well living in Thailand, but insisted. So I went to work for Petro-Saudi London in February 2010, after the deal was done. So I wasn't there when they signed, when they received the money. I knew they were doing a deal with the Malaysians, 1MDB, because that was already a topic in August 2009.
But if you're not there, how do you know for a fact that it was a fraud?
So
the only way for you to know whether it's a fraud or genuine deal if you're there.
Okay, I will explain. It's very simple. The deal was a joint venture between the 1MDB company and Petro-Saudi. You, Malaysians, the 1MDB fund, they sent, the first stage was $1 billion. And Petro-Saudi had to bring into the joint venture assets. That's what is a joint venture. You bring something, I bring something. So the Malaysians, you send the money. Petro-Saudi officially said they were bringing oil fields, mainly in Turkmenistan. This was in September, okay? In August, They had no oil fields. So out of nowhere, they found for $3 billion of oil that they brought in a joint venture. That's it.
And of course, this kind of conversation you have shared with the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission.
I've shared this with the Swiss authority, with the Malaysian authorities, and with other authorities.
But clearly, when you saw money into the bank account, something was off. Was that right?
So, again, in total, you Malaysians, the 1MDB, you send 1.8 billion, okay? The only official documents that were available to the employees, all the employees of PetroSardi, myself included, I was the number three of the company. The only official documents that we had, and I had confirmed this also to all the authorities, we had only the JP Morgan statement or bank account, where only 300 million were sent. The rest of the money was sent to the Coutts Bank, the famous Good Star account, the Jolo account. This Good Star account, this Coutts correspondence, were never, ever in the London PetroSaudi offices. This was kept between Tarek Obaid and Patrick Mahoney. Nobody, myself, the accountant, the other team, the legal team, nobody ever had access to the Good Star part of the deal.
How long did it take you to realize that something was off?
Almost immediately, but because I saw my friend Tarek having just purchased a new house, Patrick Mahoney bought a chalet in the Swiss Alps. The new offices were very expensive, but there is something to think that something is fishy, and there is another thing to know the truth. If you don't have the numbers, you don't know. It's impossible to know.
Did you ask them? Did you confront them, both Patrick and Tarek?
I spoke with them. Those two were my friends, but they never, ever show me any kind of amount, any kind of statement. The Coutts account was always said to be the Malaysian money. Mm. I even met Jolo two times during my time, once in London and once in the south of France. Tarek Obaid and Patrick Mahoney explicitly told me, don't speak business with him about the 1MDB, the PetroSaudi things. Just keep talking about whatever you want, but not businesses. This was kept, and I'm not saying that to protect me. I wasn't there when their money was received. So I cannot be in any way be implicated there. This deal, this 1.5 billion that Patrick Mahoney, Tarek Obaid, Jolo, Najib and company took as commission, this was not known in London. Only Tarek and Patrick knew.
And of course, then that's where you started to think about your own wallet. Was that the point where you started asking Tarek your salary, which is, as reported in the book, $6 million? Was that the time?
So, my relationship with Tarek was not going very well because I haven't been an employee for 20 years. I was my own boss. I had my portfolio management company. So I joined him as an employee, even as a director. So after not even a year, I couldn't stand to stay there anymore. So I resigned. I was never fired. They said in the press I was fired. No, I resigned. And this again has been shown to the Swiss authorities. So when I resigned, I asked for my severance package, and they asked me to choose my number. What you have to understand, and I'm not trying to justify this amount. You can sing whatever you want. It's your choosing. I worked for PetroSaudi since 2005. I have helped Tarek Obaid and his family many years. I left Asia to go to London. I left everything at that moment. So the moment I resigned, I asked the lawyer of Tarek Obaid at that time, I had to justify an amount. So I said, all those years, I'd make that number. This was agreed. That's where everything started. It was agreed, and at the end, not. But let's go back to this 6.5 million. It seems for a lot of people an extraordinary amount, probably. My mother was a maid. My father was a car driver. Don't you think that I know the value of the money? Do you think I will tell my mother that I was paid? I was a successful banker, so I'm used to this kind of amount. This 6.5 million, it's probably a 3 to 4 week salary of Cristiano Ronaldo or a NBA player. It's probably a third or a fourth of what a banker in Switzerland will do, even if its bank is losing money. So whatever you found this amount excessive or not, it's your personal perspective with money. I'm not asking you for a judgment, honestly. You can think, your auditors can think whatever they feel. That's the reality. I was not working as a car driver as my father.
Yeah.
I had a quite nice career in the bank. I had my own company in the finance. I was doing well. But I do understand that for people like, for example, my mother, who was cleaning houses to feed her family, it's a very big amount.
You're talking about you're not seeking judgment from people, from me, for instance. I'm not judging you on the money. I mean, if you work that hard, you believe you get that much amount of money, so be it, right? I mean, who am I to judge? What I am trying to understand more is how you intended to get that money back from your friend or former friend. Was that the decision where you decided to take away the 227,000 emails through this 90 gigabyte data? Is this like a some kind of insurance to get that money back?
No, there's nothing related with money back. So I left Petro Saudi in April 2011, okay? I was still in Geneva in May 2011. I contacted the IT guy of Petro Saudi, who was my friend. I've been confronted to him by the Swiss authorities. So in May 2011, after I resigned from Petro Saudi, I contacted him and I asked him, frankly, as a friend, can you give me a copy of the server of Petro Saudi? Just because if one day there is a problem, because there were big numbers inside the Petro Saudi deal, if there is a problem, I want to be protected. So he gave me that as a friend. He didn't ask for money. It was between friends. So he gave me those data as an insurance for any kind of problem. And I kept those data without looking at them for a few years.
Mm. And this is when you suddenly realize 3 or 4 years down the road that there is something substantial about this. And I'm sure that there are a lot of time for you to go through the data. And some allegations that were created by a lot of parties saying that you doctored the data, saying that you changed the contents of the emails, and you doctored, you know, the substantial part of it, framing a story where Joe Lo was the bad guy, Prime Minister Najib was the bad guy. That was the narrative that was carried by the previous government. Was it true? Did you doctor the data?
So I'm a banker. I'm a finance guy. I'm very bad with IT. Just for you to realize, do you know what is 227,000 emails?
I have no idea.
You will need probably more than a lifetime to go through that. So I was unable to download those data, as it was said. How can I doctor or manipulate or change? I'm not an IT guy. I'm not. So I gave the hard drive. I made a copy, of course. I gave the hard drive to Claire and the Edge. It was never manipulated. The proof is that I still have a copy, the original copy that I gave to the authorities. And they are matching. Mm. There is not a single point of difference. But of course, your previous government had no choice. They have always a choice, the criminals in general. You admit and confess, or you deny. And if you deny, you have to build a story. So the story they built was that I was the bad guy, the money-seeking guy, that I stole the data, that I downloaded the data, that I was coordinated this with the opposition, with the journalists, that everything was part of a conspiracy.
Just for the record, you're saying all that is not true?
None of that is true.
Okay.
I didn't steal the data. I didn't manipulate the data. I wasn't in any kind of conspiracy or whatever you want to name it with the opposition or the press. Not at all.
Javier, we've covered quite a few topics here, much of it which has been presented to the public through various parties, through Claire Castle Brown, P. Gunasegaram, Bradley Hope, and Tom Wright. And of course, much of these allegations are against individuals who have yet to come on the media, which is Patrick Mulhoney, Tariq Ubaid, Joe Lowe, and many others of the actors surrounding him, including the Saudi ambassador to the United States, which Tom Wright did say he's a character that we really need to, you know, look at because he was instrumental in some of the dealings. Now, I understand that you might not be privy to the entire scheme of 1MDB, just that part of PetroSaudi. That was a critical part. That was one of the first few years of this scandal taking place. Was there at any point in time that you decided to say, you know, I cannot trust the Malaysian authorities, I have to go to other powers that be, Swiss authorities, DOJ at the US, or somebody else that will investigate this? Did you ever think about going to the authorities outside of Malaysia?
No, never.
And why is that?
There is no school for whistleblowers. There is not a diploma of being a whistleblower. So what happened with me? So I was contacted by Claire. I'm not going back in the story, but I gave the data. And that's it. I said, hey, I've done my duty.
Where is Tariq Ubaid right now? Or Patrick Mulhoney, for that matter?
So Switzerland is a very small country. Geneva is a kind of a village. So Mr. Ubaid hasn't lived Switzerland, hasn't left Switzerland since probably for the last 2 years. I do think, and we have some kind of common friends, he's quite afraid of being arrested. He has a Swiss passport. There is no better place for being arrested than Switzerland. The prison facilities are a very high level. So he's there. He has been under investigation. Some of his assets have been frozen. And Mr. Patrick Mulhoney is, from time to time, he's between Geneva and London.
Let's talk about Patrick Mulhoney. When you were in Thailand, you were reportedly asked to lie on your confession. These days you're saying that it was done under duress, that even the script was written in perfect English. These are the kind of allegations that you throw, saying that there is possibly a UK citizen that is dictating you the terms. Was it Patrick Mulhoney?
I was arrested, sent to the Bangkok prison. Before going to the prison, I was introduced to a guy by the chief of police of Bangkok, who is quite a big shot. So
Bangkok chief of police introduced you to this individual?
To this guy, to this Scotland Yard officer. I had no experience. I'd never been to jail. So I was introduced to this guy that presented himself as a Scotland Yard officer. He asked me to plead guilty and to confess whatever he wanted me to confess. And I said, no, I'm not going to confess something I didn't do. They sent me to jail, to the worst cell you can imagine. They led me there for 3-4 days. I don't remember. And this Paul Finnegan came to see me. He said, hey, the deal is you stay there 10 years in this particular cell, or you cooperate with us. It's an international investigation between Malaysia, Thailand, and the UK, and you will be home before Christmas. If you don't, you will spend there 10 years. Patrick Mulhoney came the following day with the same speak. I was meeting them just to realize that in all the prisons, probably even in Thailand, you have a visiting facility. I was meeting them in the office of the number one and number two of the prison, with air conditioning, with coffee, with some goodies. I really thought that this was done through Scotland Yard. You know my level of English. It's quite okay. If you read my confessions, it's done by an English guy. He was dictating me for weeks. And I may be stupid, maybe, Will I accept to do all of this by saying I don't want my lawyer present in a country where I don't speak the language? I'm not crazy enough to do that. I had no choice. So whatever I have to do to get out of there, I did it. I confess, I put names, they asked me they build a script that I had to follow. This was done. They organized 3 meetings with the journalist, one from the Straight Time. He gave the question in advance to this Paul Finnegan. So I had the question for the interview a day in advance, so I had time to prepare it. And the speech that I had to do was the same. I was the bad guy, I steal the data, I was working with the journalists, Claire Castle-Brown and so on. I was part of working with the opposition. I had to say that. It's worse than that. In the middle of January 2016, I had a visit from the Malaysian police that came to interview me in prison. There were 55 or 57 questions. Those questions, I received them a day in advance. I was briefed for one day by this Paul Finnegan with a guy from the Thai police. So when the Malaysian delegation came, they asked me these 57 or 55 questions. I answered in less than an hour. Okay? And this is part of our criminal complaints in Switzerland and in the UK, because I cannot show you that, but we have, my wife has proof of this pre-arrangement with the questioning.
Let's talk more about Paul Finnegan, right? And when he was doing all this, you had no access to your lawyers to check his background? I don't know, simple things.
It's something, you may not believe it, but that's a fact. My first Thai lawyers were hired and paid by PetroSaudi. My Swiss lawyer that came, my first lawyer, not the actual ones, my first Swiss lawyer from one of the biggest firms in Switzerland, it's called Lalive. It's probably the first or the second law firm in Switzerland. They sent a lawyer, Maître Anzelin, which is quite not a famous, but a well-known guy. He was paid by PetroSaudi to defend me. He was paid more than $200,000. He came and spent maybe 6-7 days in Bangkok to defend me. He has no authority to defend my case in the Thai court. He was just there to do a press media campaign against me when he went back to Switzerland. That's a fact. That is given to the Swiss authorities. He was paid $200,000 to defend me. How on earth will a lawyer be paid by the guy that are sending another guy to prison? It's not illegal. It's completely immoral. If like we have a dispute, I send you to jail, and to defend you, I will hire your lawyer. It may be legal, but it's totally unethical.
But everybody has the right to deny access to a particular lawyer. Why didn't you reject these lawyers?
It was my first time experience with this kind of things. Have you ever been to a Thai prison?
I have never been to any prison.
Okay. I don't wish that for you, but believe me, the day you are sleeping on the ground with real criminals, when you have to sleep naked because it's like 50 degrees inside, that you have 50 people who's using the toilet from 6 in the afternoon to 6 in the morning, whatever people tell you to do, and they said this is the way for you to be reunited with your family. Do that, write this, say that. To go home, to be with my wife and my son. I've done that. They could have asked pretty much whatever. I would have done it. Because nobody can realize, unless they've been in a Thai prison, what it's like being in a Thai prison.
You were also being visited by Swiss authorities, not just Swiss lawyers, but Swiss authorities while your time there in a Thai prison or Bangkok prison. How was it like?
So there is 2 chapters with the Swiss authorities. The first one, I was a prisoner like another. I was sentenced to 3 years, or 6 years, but divided by 3 because I pleaded guilty. They did PetroSaudi and company and the lawyers did a press campaign against me. So I was looked as a criminal, which is normal. My wife had to leave back to Switzerland because she was threatened to be arrested if I stopped cooperating or if she went public. So she left in May 2016. I was alone for like 7 months. So the minute she landed in Europe, she did this press campaigning with Claire Rucastle Brown, with The Guardian. She met the FBI, she met the UK authorities, the Swiss authorities, the ambassador, the federal prosecutor. So when the Swiss authorities realized that I was just a tool, the innocent guy that was in jail to cover the crimes, they gave me an incredible support. And if I'm here today, it's thanks to the Swiss and to my wife.
Laura Giusto connected with Claire Rucastle Brown to bring your story to light. What is known is that after a few period of time working with Claire, your wife went away, didn't connect with Claire Rucastle Brown. Why was that communication ceased? Why did your wife stop talking to Claire Rucastle Brown in the middle of a process of trying to exonerate you from these allegations?
She was under pressure. They were threatening her. And this again, we have so many evidences. They said, Patrick Mahoney, Paul Finnegan, that if she stopped cooperating or if she spoke with Claire, I will end up probably dead or extradited to Malaysia. So she's a woman. She's a mother. I'm the husband. I'm the father. She had to do what she had to do to protect me. So she cut off the ties with Claire. They even forced her to tape Claire. Okay? They put an application on her phone to tape Claire, Patrick Mahoney and Tarek Obaid and Paul Finnegan, in order to try to manipulate Claire. But thanks to this recording, even criminals that steal a lot of money are stupid. So they forced my wife to put an app to record Claire, but they forgot to take it out. So all the conversation that they had together, my wife and Patrick, are on record. All of this, it's a bunch of documents like this, have been submitted to the Swiss authorities. That's probably why they're under investigation.
Sorry, it's just unbelievable. You're telling me a story that is so amateurish, right? I mean, if it's true what you say, that is.
Believe me, it's true. I have no reason to tell those fairy tales. It's a known fact. Unfortunately, it's under investigation. I will not send you some documents. I may send you a couple of pages if you want for your auditors one day.
We'll get
but there. There is a lot of recording of conversation. The same conversation that Patrick Mahoney, you can hear it on The Guardian or on the Sarawak blog and on others, where Patrick Mahoney is saying, hey, we are in the deep shit because of you. A prime minister is in a deep shit because of that. Those conversations were taped because there may be good criminals in stealing money, but sometimes they made mistakes. And thanks to those mistakes, they will probably end up in jail.
Let's talk about the meeting that you had with Joe Lo. You were alluding just now, you met Joe Lo twice. What were discussed?
I couldn't talk financials, as I said before. Patrick Mahoney and Tarek Obaid say, hey, don't talk business with him. He is representing Malaysian Prime Minister Rosmah and himself. So this has to be secret, the deal with the Malaysians. So I met the guy two times and we spoke, I don't even remember, probably about the quality of the food in the London restaurant or the weather in the south of France. Nothing less, nothing more.
What do you make out of this character, this Joe Lo, when you met him personally?
So that's very strange because now having read the books and knowing what he did, first time I met him, for me, it was not a criminal, of course. It's such, I would say, even a low profile. He's a very, like, doesn't make noise. It's almost like, you know, you could expect that for people like this stealing billions, partying, and buying jets, yachts, people will be like, very like, I don't know, passionate, very living. But he is very, like, I would say a shy character.
And nothing tipped you off in terms of?
No, honestly, nothing.
Like all
except
these guys.
That he is, I would say, a very discreet guy, which at the end is probably the opposite.
When we started this interview, you said that Malaysia was fortunate enough to have a prime minister like Tun Dr. Mahathir. Tell us about how you first came in contact with him or his people.
So I'm not in a position to reveal all the details, but I haven't asked the authorization to reveal names, but that's not relevant how I came in contact or why I came. Or the fact is I met your prime minister, and he's one of the best moments I had in my life. Not only because he's a very
I think it's
caring character.
I'm sorry, I have to press on this. I think it's very relevant, the context how you met the prime minister, or at least his people.
Okay, I met him because I came to meet him. And to be clear, because some people have been asking that, I paid for my travels. Nobody invited me, nobody financed me, nobody gave me any kind of money or incentive. I came here because I wanted to be here, because the victory of Dr. Mahathir and this new government, it's also a little bit my victory. I'm not taking the cover it's not for my own glory, but I wanted to be there at that moment.
And through this period of time, were there anything that the Prime Minister, Tun Mahathir, asked you to say or not say to the authorities or the public?
Not a second.
So everything is on your own volition. You're doing this voluntarily in terms of speaking to the authorities, coming to the media.
Absolutely. I came here because I wanted to be here. Nobody called me, hey, please come, I will send you the tickets or whatever. I wanted to be present. Mm. It's very personal. But again, if I've been through a lot. So this achievement means a lot for me and means a lot, of course, for my wife.
You have a lot going for you, but you know, somehow or other, Malaysia is now interconnected with your life.
That's a fact.
For better or worse, what message do you want to give out to Malaysians coming out of this particular ordeal that you went through?
So I've been meeting a lot of Malaysians during my visits here. I'm quite a well-known figure in Malaysia, so the only thing I can say is trust your government. Have patience, because a lot of people would like to see Najib and company already in jail. But there is a process. First, you need to have a police investigation, charges, and a trial. Guilty or not guilty, it depends on the justice. You have to respect this. If you want to do it the other way and just arrest the guys and send them to jail, that's fine. But you will act as they will have acted. You will be as good or as bad as they are. So it's your choosing. Just have faith. It's a new start for your country. You have to rebuild a lot of things, a lot of confidence. You have a lot of financial problems ahead of you that you have to solve. So trust your government, and that's it. And another message, it's now you know what can happen if you don't control what is going on in your country. You know, if you give all the powers to a single guy that can be prime minister, minister of finance, and running the national fund, you may face another problem. But this time will not be his responsibility or hers responsibility if you have a woman as a prime minister. It will be yours. It will be the Malaysian people. Because that now you know the consequences. Mm.
Thank you very much for joining us, Javier. And of course, this is a very critical conversation that we have had with Javier Justo. And if you want to continue on this conversation, just go to astronomy.com. Perhaps you can have a two-way conversation there as well. Again, thank you very much. You've been watching the special edition of Bulletin Awani Khas. I'm Ibrahim Sani, signing off. Thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure.